I moved.
Okay, welcome back. I'm now very pleased to introduce Jan Willis, who will give us the next talk. Jan was born and grew up in a small town near Birmingham, Alabama, or should I say Birmingham, sorry, Alabama, which was then and probably still is one of the most segregated places in America. So as you can imagine, as a youngster, Jan was out there marching. But I'm not going to give you give a whole biography because we want to hear Jan, not me. In any case, my voice may not last very long. I'll just perhaps say that she was one of the earliest scholars and practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism in America, and I believe you've studied and taught for 3 or 4 decades. Yeah, something like that. And is now Professor of Religion at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. If you want to know more about how she made this incredible transition from Alabama, then I suggest you read her book, Dreaming Me, an African-American Woman's Spiritual Journey. And there are a few copies at the bookstall at the back there. In 2000, Time magazine rated Jan as one of the 6 spiritual innovators for the new millennium. So I'm very pleased to welcome you here from across the Atlantic. And, well, the new millennium is now a little way on, but we'll see. Anyway,
what's a Jan spiritual Willis. Innovator?
Anyway.
Thank you. Oh, thank you all. I am very glad to be here. It was one of those rush trips where you grade 64 papers, and you pack, and you wash, and you think about where's your passport, and you do all of that, and you get on the plane, and then you can relax. But since I have to get back for a Wednesday class in which we're reading the new translation of The Life of Mila, I read that on the plane. Finished, but I noticed that there were, have you done this? It's Andrew Quinton's biography of Milarepa. And there's a lot of crying that goes on in that book. You know, she said this, and then we all wept. And I was almost weeping on the plane. At any rate, it's been lovely to get here. I appreciate the invitation. And I've had a wonderful time being hosted by Pat Simmons, who has given me not only a good warm tea whenever I need it, hot tea, but a tour of the city, which I've really enjoyed. Didn't see the suspension bridge close up, but so I went to 2 cathedrals and 1 church. There you go. Beautiful, beautiful. And I got a Bristol University sweatshirt, which is also what I asked for. So now I'm desireless. So I've had a fantastic day and a half or so, and meeting wonderful folk. Appreciate that. Now, my great pleasure at being here is tempered by the fact that I didn't get to meet personally with John Crook. I never had met him, and I look forward to it from the moment that I got these early emails from Jake saying that he and John would like to invite me to this conference. I thought, wonderful. And I'll get a chance to meet you as well, Jake, but you know. No, I didn't mean it like that, but anyway. And then when I heard from Jake that John Crook had rather suddenly passed away, I thought, oh, that's really sad, and I won't get to meet him. And within a couple of weeks, a DVD arrived in the mail which had been filmed by David Cherniak. It's a film documentary called Dharma Rising, Buddhism in the West. And John Crook, there he was, giving an interview with David Cherniak. So I got to see him a little, to listen to him, to find out about his deep thinking on about interdependence and about karma and about how one of the ways we can think about this is as, you know, we are who we are because biologically there's something in the genes that carries on. I thought, wow, great way, innovative way of talking about karma and our interrelatedness and this whole thing. So I was graced by this DVD arriving, but still, it would have been nice to meet him in person. But all things are conditioned. So we're told in our Buddhism, we learn in our experience. But still, so today I'm happy to be here and to be a part of this conversation with all of you. One of Jake's early emails to me asked me if I would continue the discussion that he understood I was having or beginning at Bernie Glassman's farm last year, socially engaged in symposium, wherein I had said something like, Buddhism is intrinsically engaged. And so that's what I'm going to try to do today. I think what I had actually said was, I have never thought of Buddhism as not being engaged. I never thought of it that way. And I'm sure that part of that comes from my own background. And I think that's true for all of us. Once Kala Rinpoche said at a talk back in 74 in Berkeley, he said, look at all of you gathered here. I don't think any of you were born in a Buddhist country, but you've all come with an interest in Buddhism. You know, it's like saying, what's up with that? You know, like, where did that come from? And so we all come from our own particular backgrounds, you know, families, their causes and conditions that have brought us to Buddhism. And my particular set of childhood and growing up culture, causes and conditions happen to be that I'm a black woman from the Jim Crow South in the U.S. at a particular time. So service has always been important to me. And this working with, I didn't work with King, I wasn't one of the organizers of King's marches, but I was a 15-year-old who marched with King every chance I could. You know, you get away from school, you get a ride downtown and you go. You know, no wonder our parents worry, you know. They sent us off to school and then we went downtown to march. It was wonderful, and sometimes I marched with my parents. So I come from sort of that spiritual, ethical, you know, impulse to right wrongs. So I want to say something about King today, a person with whom I see a lot of parallels between things that Martin Luther King said and things that the Buddha said, so I want to draw that out a bit more as well. So, to go back again, I never thought of Buddhism as being anything except engaged, though I recognize that there are different ways of taking that phrase. And what I had actually said, I think, and I repeated it later, at another Engaged Buddhism conference, what I said was, the very fact, it seems to me, the very fact that the Buddha got up from that meditation seat of kusha grass in Bodh Gaya and went off to find someone to share the Dharma with shows that it was engaged. He got up. he went and shared. He went looking for people to teach this doctrine to, because having found it himself, having realized it himself, having seen as he looked from one extreme to reality to the other, the whole of Buddhakoti, he didn't see Atman. And as a result of not seeing it, he felt lighter. He could put down that burden. And he felt freed. Because he got up from that seat, we today know something about Buddhism, this thing we call Buddha. I mean, if he just stayed blissed out under that tree for 7 days, or as the texts tell us, move from one tree to another, seven different trees, for 7 weeks he was blissed out. If he had just stayed there in his own individual and personal enlightenment bliss, we wouldn't hear the term Buddhism. Well, you know, it's a Western term anyway, but we wouldn't know about Buddhist Dharma. So it seems to me the Buddha's example, so Mahayana, isn't it? The Buddha's example, standing up and going to teach the doctrine, already is engaged Buddhism, seems to me. And why should we do anything less? So this passionate, compassionate urge to share the teachings for the good of all, for me, is the heart of Buddhism, and certainly the heart of engaged Buddhism. In a certain sense, I think, all Buddhism is engaged. Wherever and whenever one seeks earnestly to apply him or herself to Buddhist practice, even if only to a certain number of hours per week on a cushion, still that's engaged. There's already a connection between ourselves. There's already a connection between us and the world. So if we're practicing earnestly, and if we don't live in the cave, if we can carry our practice along with us as we do our activities in the world, I think this is engaged Buddhism, and I think that's what Thich Nhat Hanh had in mind. It's what you do all the time. If you've seriously taken refuge, place trust in Buddha Dharma Sangha, if you carry that with you all the time, it is engaged Buddhism. Also, I think that our individual practices of meditative discipline, of calming our minds and establishing minds of peace, automatically generates that peace into our surroundings. So whether we actively, self-consciously, I know self, but you know what I mean, are intending to do anything, still we spread peace. There's also another sense of engaged Buddhism, and this might be more specifically titled socially engaged Buddhism. You know, once I received a phone call from a woman in California asking me if I could come out right away for this conference. It had been some kind of oversight. They hadn't thought to invite me, but now they had. And because I had, of course I was coming. And I said something like, well, I was in my office, and I said, well, I'm not sure I can actually make that, such short notice. And she said, well, you are engaged, aren't you? You are an engaged Buddhist. You know, people like that, you know. So I think we have to be careful with these terms. And I think Donald Rothberg was trying to do that in his article, Listening to the Cries of the World, and also in his book, you know, Leading an Engaged Spiritual Life. He says, well, maybe we should be more careful to make a distinction between engaged Buddhism and socially engaged Buddhism, so we're not blaming somebody. We look at them, oh, they just meditate. They're not engaged. You know? We don't want to be in the, you know, good Buddhists, we don't want to be in the business of blaming others. Oh, you just meditate. You Chan people, you know, you just turn to the wall, forget all about people. Just joking. But I think we have to do something about that, you know. We don't want to be like the woman who said, well, you are engaged, aren't you? So Rothberg suggested that we say socially engaged Buddhism when we are self-consciously wedding the principles of Buddhism and some social, cultural, political activity, ecological activity. We can say, well, we're going to put these two together. We see that there are good principles here in Buddhism, and we want to get involved with this activism, and we put them, consciously, but put them together. So he says, let's call that, let's add another term to that and say that's socially engagement. Okay. All right. I don't think, that so much matters. I just think it's important that we not internally blame each other. Oh, there are different ways of being engaged, which is something Jake, I think, was saying. There are different ways, there are different levels, if you will. And I'm happy for all of it. Oh. But some Western Buddhists seem to have a difficulty thinking about socially engaged Buddhism, thinking perhaps there's something artificial about it, or thinking perhaps this just doesn't rest well with my particular personality or my particular approach or my particular practice. So that's okay. I hope we'll talk more about that. I personally don't see a problem with it. Rather, I cannot imagine Buddhist practice without engagement. So I'll just say, I represent that position. Happy to talk further. Oh, okay. That is because it seems to me that centrally, Buddhism is about relieving suffering. I know there's the conceit, and we want to avoid against that conceit. I did this and this was good. And I hope this person, I'm going to give this, you know, to that person. And I hope he goes and he tells his friends I gave it to him. Well, I mean, that's not Buddhism. That's no way to lessen the ego. We know that, you know. We're digging a hole deeper for ourselves in samsara if we act that way. It's not about some kind of pretense. Oh. But if we believe, I think we all do, we find something that answers this in Buddhism. Buddhism is first and foremost about relieving suffering. So it seems to me that means trying as best we can to get involved in that activity ourselves. And not just relief of my own suffering, and this is where it moves out, but relief of others' suffering as well. Here I am in complete agreement with Burma's Dao Aung San Suu Kyi. In 1995, she had a series of conversations when she was just released from house arrest, and she talked over several months with an American visitor who had been in Burma previously as a Burmese monk. And they had this conversation. It was published as The Voice of Hope. And in the series of conversations, at one point, Aung San Suu Kyi says the following: engaged Buddhism is active compassion, active metta. It's not just sitting there passively and saying, oh, I feel sorry for all those people. It means doing something about the situation by bringing whatever relief you can to those who need it the most, by caring for them, by doing what you can to help others. End quote. So, to the present, as the present conference title, Western Buddhism Engaged Buddhism. I looked at that, and at first I didn't see the question mark. And then I saw the question mark, and I thought, ooh, what am I getting into here? So I think I've started to cover one of them. I said, well, you know, I'm not sure. Are they having a problem? What's the problem? So I've already started to give one response to this. I think all Buddhism is engaged, and practicing sitting meditation is engaged Buddhism, and if we don't blame one another, you know. You know, in the sense that Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, making of ourselves peace, or in the sense that Aye Maste says, you know, there's no path to peace. Peace is itself the path. You know, if we meditate and we become more peaceful, then I think that's just automatically that peace fans out, spreads out. So that's fine. That's a way of being engaged. You are relieving suffering. You're causing peace to spread. You're helping beings to feel peaceful. I also think that there are more systemic problems in the world and that we have to deal with those too. So there's one point to in connection with your title. The other point was this. If we are asking ourselves with any hesitancy, whether or not the two categories, or practicing Buddhism here and practicing some form of activism here, if we have a question about whether those activities properly or not belong together, if they belong together properly or not, then we should say that, and then we should try to ask ourselves why it is that we feel that way and to articulate that. My teacher, Lama Tupten Yeshe, used to always say, you know, he learned English from us hippies, and so he used to always say, you have to check up, dear, check up. You have to check up. Please check up, dear, check up, check up. You know, this is like Ehi Pasika, the Buddha, you know, you have to come and see for yourself. Check with your own experience. So Lama Yeshe's shortcut was check up. You have to check up, dear, check up. So we have to check up. What's the hesitancy? Oh, what's the hesitancy about? Do we just think that those are, you know, that's a wrong conception that just Westerners have? Do we think so? Do we think it's artificial? Oh, would we simply prefer to practice meditation in isolation from others, and from involvement with the world? I just want to meditate. Leave me alone. I'm good at this. I'm happy. Buddhism is about being happy. I'm happy when I do this. Leave me alone. And if that's the case, you know, are we ready to cop to that? That's how we want to approach things. It's okay. We're still relieving some suffering. It's good. Are we truly interested in the welfare of others? Do we think it's possible to be of help given the massive problems we face and the limited time we have to address them? Our world would be very, very different if we make it. We probably, those gathered here, won't live to see it. But by 2100, the world would be very, very, very different. Do we think that, and here I think this is probably legitimate, it happens a lot. Do we think that we serve others better? Do we think that we serve others better by tending to our own raging elephant minds? If so, I ask, do we know what would constitute our being ready? We think, oh, I can't do that. And nobody should, and it'll just be full of self anyway, if we start acting when we're not sufficiently grounded in our practice. Then I think we should ask ourselves, what would constitute our being ready? Do we have a sense of that? I think those are fair questions to pose to ourselves, and I hope we will do so these 2 days. I've told you a bit and about where I've come from, so I often bring in King. How am I doing time-wise? Got plenty of time? Good. Okay. It's hard for me not to pair Martin Luther King's sayings from his sermons, primarily, and sayings of the Buddha. I see them as making just great pairs for making points clearer. And you should know that in my memoir, I call myself a Baptist Buddhist. You should know that. It's not a theological point. I should clear that up right away. But it is, I think, an honest description of how I think I am. In crisis situations, I'm still likely to call on both traditions, as I did once when the plane was going down, I thought. At any rate. So according to my, so I haven't left the Baptist tradition. Oh, I simply found techniques that work in Buddhism. You know, when the Bible says, when Matthew says, you know, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Sounds good to me, but how the heck do you do it? I couldn't find a method, or as Lama Yeshe would say, a method. What's the method, dear? I couldn't find that method in my Baptist churches. I did, however, find numerous methods within Buddhism. So I was fortunate that way. So in that sense, I call myself a Baptist Buddhist. I think there are virtues to be found in both the Christian tradition and the Buddhist one, but I find the techniques for bringing about change that are usable for me, I found with Buddhists, and particularly with Tibetan Buddhists. But according to my Baptist upbringing, service to others is a fundamental principle. Service. And some of us might have different ideas about what that term means, but coming from my background, it's just fundamental. Dr. King said, anyone can be great because anyone can serve. I go, yes, let us serve. Tell us what to do, let us go. So he loved the New Testament parable of the Good Samaritan, and so this speaks to me, speaks to me deeply. You know the story, the Good Samaritan, biblical story. And Dr. King, when he was giving a sermon on that particular parable, towards the end, you know, as the pastor's building up the sermon, Dr. King says, who in this case is the true Samaritan? You know, is the person lying there on the road. The Levite comes by and skips to the other side. And then this person from Samaria, which would have been anathema in the mouths of a Jew of his day. The Samaritan comes along and sees him and binds his wound and puts him on his ass and takes him to a place and pays the man and says, if this is not enough to care for him, when I come back through, I'll give you some more. Dr. King asks, who is the true Samaritan? And then answers the question by saying, the true Samaritan was not the one who asked himself, not the one who thought, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? The true Samaritan was the one who asked, if I do not stop to help this man, then what will happen to him? Isn't that the true meaning of an Atman? Isn't that selflessness? If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's what matters. Dr. King understood the notion of interdependence. He knew that helping another was ultimately the same as helping oneself. He spoke often of the interrelated structure of reality. In one of the sermons, he says, and it's an oft-quoted phrase, he says, "All men are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be." Service to each other is part of who we are. And I too had Desmond Tutu's Ubuntu piece, the piece that Jay quoted. It's part of who we are as human beings. In fact, that's how we know that we are human beings, when we know that we belong, when we know that we're in this bundle of life, when we know that what we are to do is to act humanely, which means share with each other, being responsible for each other. That's what Ubuntu means. My favorite, one of my favorite, I think probably my favorite Buddhist verse is Dhammapada. I heard myself going away from the mic. Is Dhammapada 183. Dhammapada 183, I think, sums up Buddhist. If I'm thinking in Tibetan, I go, oh. So I heard myself then. And other times, I tell my students, I say tikaha a lot, which is, you know, Hindi for okie dokie. Just moving right along. So I interject that. I'm sorry. Tikaha. Biblically. If you go to Matthew 22, verses 36 to 41, you will find that encounter where the scholar comes up to Jesus and, wishing to humiliate him, asks, "Rabbi, what is the first commandment?" And Jesus responds, "To love that thou should love God with thy whole heart and mind. And the second is like unto it, to love thy neighbor as thyself." Now, I think that's one of the most concise descriptions of Christian doctrine and practice you can find in those few verses. Love the Lord thy God and love thy neighbor. How do you show it? How do you show it in practice that you love God? You love your neighbor. That's the practice. In Buddhism, I think verse 183 encapsulates Buddhism very, very well. That verse says, do no harm. Practice virtue. Purify the mind. This all the Buddhists teach. So I think that, again, tells us what to do, and it tells us how to behave, if you will. It tells us what to do. So I love verse 183, Dhammapada. None harm. The practice of what is good, not just for oneself, but checking up what is good for oneself and is good for others. And in order to accomplish any of these, they need to be practiced together. They too are interrelated. So I can understand that one might not want to act before one had practiced. That it's interrelated. These three are themselves interrelated. I think to attempt to do one without the other two is futile. Shantideva told us again, if you wish to be happy, practice compassion. If you wish others to be happy, practice compassion. So simple. So simple. So simple. It's challenging, but so simple. And I also like very much Arya Rutney's Sarbodaya Shramadan, their dictum, which says, "We together, we build the road, and the road builds us." I very much think that if we could do projects together, we would not only accomplish those projects and help others, but come together ourselves as a community. So I think that Shramadana ethic, that if we volunteer our effort, Shramadana, if we give effort, then everyone altogether is uplifted. Sarva Udya. We're all uplifted together if we offer our labor together. In so many ways, I see that as good teachings. And I thought, as Justice Jake, when I was preparing for this, I started to see every place, you know, here, quotes, these are usable, you know. So I usually talk about just King and maybe Dubois, but I don't think about Du Bois, but I don't think about Booker T. Washington much. But then there was this quote from Booker T. Washington: "If you want to lift yourself up, lift up someone else." Yes, I said, good going, Booker. I find that some of the methods, and I think King really did address some methods, and some of these methods parallel what I've learned about some Buddhist methods. So this idea that kept me as a young person wondering, how is it that we can love our neighbors when many of our neighbors literally are KKK members who come and disrupt our gatherings? They came once too, I was telling Mike, I came to a birthday party when I was very young and came in, who's having a party? Who's being happy up here in the black side of the camp? You know, that shouldn't be happening. So they came in and they jostled this kid around, broke his arm. And I remember being pretty small, and I also remember being terrified that my mother had told me, you dare not go to that birthday party because after school you better come straight home. I went to the birthday party, it's right behind the school. And the Klan came, broke up the party, broke the boy's arm, and I thought, where were the parents? Couldn't they protect him? Anyway, so, the point. So I found it very difficult. How to love your neighbor. If your neighbor might come in wearing one of those hoods and sort of hated you, or at least at that moment seemed to. I found answers in both King and in Buddhism. So let me briefly tell you about those because I think my time might be running out. So I found it hard to imagine how you could practice sort of loving kindness. I found things that King said about this, and they were very practical things. That's why I mentioned it here. They're very practical. King said in a sermon called Loving Your Enemies. You know, we don't have any enemies in Buddhism. The enemies are just those three enemies, you know, those three ratna. My goodness. Those three enemies are just ignorance, greed, and hatred. Those are the enemies. No person who might have them, right? We're in agreement on that, aren't we? Yes. But King gave a sermon called Loving Your Enemies. And in that he said, now I always respected this as being such a rational thing. You know, it's like going through the steps in your mind first, you know, not letting those emotions take over, but sort of rationally. So King said, I found it really interesting in this sermon, he said, in order to love one's enemies, one has to be able, first, to use reasoning in order to see that in one hate-filled moment, one has not seen all that another person is. Right? One sees one slice of life of that individual. That person may be quite angry now, but at other points in the day, kissed the wife goodbye, picked up a child, and hugged them. That person has loving moments. We all have Buddha nature, or we all have Christ within, you know. Very practical, King said. We have to first think, we have to recognize that hateful moment, that moment of that person that we're seeing now is not all that that person is. There is more to him, just as there is more to us. Actually, King elaborated three particular practical steps in loving one's enemies. The process of transforming hatred into compassion is first, he said, we must develop and maintain the capacity to forgive. Sounds simple, but oh. Second, we must recognize that the evil that is being perpetrated never quite expresses all that another person is. And third, we must seek reconciliation and to, quote, win over, we must be willing to win the friend's friendship, the enemy's friendship and understanding. So simple and yet so challenging. And some of us say, well, we're not ready yet to practice. We must practice to practice engagement. We must practice more before we seek to engage in actions which help fellow human beings. I hear that, I understand it. If you can imagine being a young girl from the South, I thought there was nothing I could do ever to help anyone, to be able to contribute. But then luckily I met my teachers, things changed. We Buddhists say that we know that We Buddhists say that we know that the problem is ultimately in here. It's in here. The hatred, the greed, the ignorance, those ashvaranas, they have to be eliminated. The cause of suffering, that needs to be eliminated. And so we practice to eliminate those. So we Buddhists know where the real problem is. It's in here. So I just want to say today, there are also problems out there. There are problems in here, but there are also problems out there. And David would recognize this in terms of saying, we can recognize hatred, greed, and delusion in ourselves. And there is also systemic or institutional hatred, greed, and delusion. We can work on those too. In other words, those enemies are also out there. And when they become systematized and are used against people, then we should, I think. I know that's a heavy word. Then we should, I think, work to defeat those. So there's a basic problem, and we know that, we good Buddhists know that it's internal, but it's also out there. There are things out there which I think need to be actively worked on and against. Poverty, for example, needs to be worked on. Clean drinking water needs to be worked on. Euphemistically styled food insecurity needs to be worked on. One of six people right now is hungry. One in six goes to bed hungry. That needs to be worked on. Hunger, climate change, education, these things need to be worked on. The prison industrial complex needs to be worked on. There is much work that needs to be done. And there is much work which absolutely cannot wait. You can't wait till we're ready. You can't wait till we're perfect. You can't wait till we're Samyak Sambuddhas. It can't wait that long. Some work needs to be done now. If I have time, I'd like to read just a bit of what the Dalai Lama says at the end of Ethics for a New Millennium. He calls it an appeal. Is it okay?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. He calls it an appeal. The best way to ensure, and I thought at one point, I'll just take the appeal and read that. I won't have to prepare. At any rate, so these are some excerpts from the appeal at the conclusion of Ethics for the New Millennium, His Holiness. The best way to ensure that when we approach death, he's at the end of his book, he's talking, so when we approach death. The best way to ensure that when we approach death, we do so without remorse, is to ensure that in the present, we conduct ourselves responsibly and with compassion for others. Actually, this is in our own interest, and not just because it will benefit us in the future. As we have seen, compassion is one of the principal things that makes our lives meaningful. It is the source of all lasting happiness and joy. Through kindness, through affection, through honesty, through truth and justice towards all others, we ensure our own benefit. This is not a matter of complicated theorizing. It is a matter of common sense. There's no denying that consideration of others is worthwhile. There is no denying that our happiness is inextricably bound up with the happiness of others. There is no denying that if society suffers, we ourselves suffer. Thus, we can reject everything else, religion, ideology, all received wisdom, but we cannot escape the necessity of love and compassion. Therefore, with my two hands joined, I appeal to you, the reader, to ensure that you make the rest of your life as meaningful as possible. Do this by engaging in spiritual practice, if you can. As I have made clear, there is nothing mysterious about this. It consists of nothing more than acting out of concern for others. That's how he defines spiritual practice. If you cannot, for whatever reason, be of help to others, then at least don't harm them. Consider yourself a tourist. Think of the world as seen from space, so small and insignificant, yet so beautiful. Could there be anything to be gained from harming others during our brief stay here? Is it not preferable and more reasonable to relax and enjoy ourselves quietly, just as if we were visiting a different neighborhood? Therefore, in the midst of your enjoyment of the world, you have a moment. No, if in your enjoyment of the world you have a moment, then try to help in however small a way those who are downtrodden and those who, for whatever reason, cannot or do not help themselves. Try not to turn away from those whose appearance is disturbing, from the ragged and unwell. Try never to think of them as inferior to yourself. If you can, try not even to think of yourself as better than the humblest beggar. You will look the same in your grave. He would probably laugh too at that. His Holiness ends the book with a short prayer, and it comes from two verses in Shantideva. This is the conclusion of my talk. And he says, may I become it. It's from Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatar, The Way of the Bodhisattva, chapter 3, verses 18 and 19. May I become at all times, both now and forever, a protector of those without protection, a guide for those who have lost their way, a ship for those with oceans to cross, a bridge for those with rivers to cross, a sanctuary for those in danger, a lamp for those without a light, a place of refuge for those who lack shelter, and a servant to all in need. The Buddha exhorted his first 60 ordained Sangha members while they were still practicing, not perfect Samyak Sambuddhas, saying, quote, "Go forth, O bhikkhus, for the welfare of the many, for the happiness of the many, for the good, for the well-being and happiness of gods and men. Preach the Dharma that is sublime in the beginning, sublime in the middle, sublime in the end. Proclaim the holy Dharma, altogether perfect and pure." So how do we demonstrate that we understood the Buddha's message, his teachings, or of Christ's teachings for that matter, by being compassionate, by loving our neighbors, by loving our enemies, indeed by working for the will of humankind, for the welfare of the many, for the happiness of the many, for the good, the well-being, and the happiness of gods and men? The important thing is doing. Compassion is wisdom in action. With courage, I hope we can begin to act together. Thank you.